Is advice.
This is the Liam Sheff Show on UCY TV and Truth Frequency Radio. It looks like we're in the country, but I don't know if you can hear the sound. But just over there, goes the endless roar of traffic. Wherever you are in America, there are cars. And cars bring us everything that we need. Trucks bring everything to stores where our cars go and bring it back home. This causes some of us a certain amount of concern and anxiety. I'm going to talk about that for a minute, and you can listen to the cars in the background to make my point. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. You can also go watch The Oil Alarm. What's the most important thing in the world? That's how I start my video, The Oil Alarm, on oil. Is it love? The people at Collective Evolution would like you to believe that love is the most important thing, and if we just invest enough in love, somehow we'll have enough to eat. Is it money? Well, money makes the world go round, but really the world goes around without us just fine, unless of course you live on the flat earth, in which case the world doesn't move at all, and somebody's just having a lot of fun at our expense. Who knows? Maybe it's the Rockefellers. For the rest of us, though, living on this swiftly tilting planet, spinning, going around the sun, the moon going around us, we've come to rely on something called food to get through the day, to power us so that we can have sufficient energy and enough material in our bowels to go to the bathroom at the end. We built toilets just as a kind of means of celebrating or honoring the god of feces, which plumbs our depths daily and nightly, unless you're very unlucky, in which case I would suggest eating a little more oatmeal. You could eat a few ripe bananas, even a day. Chia seed and water, take, you know, a quart of water and maybe 5-8 tablespoons of chia seed, a little lemon juice, you'll be fine. Do that for 2 days in a row. You'll wonder what constipation is. Food is the most important thing in the world because it's what makes us move. But food comes from somewhere, and it doesn't just come from the field behind me, which is dry because California is dry. It comes from this little thing called the highway. Our food on average comes from 12 to 1500 miles away. Some of our food comes from 3,500 miles away. Some of our food comes from 5,000 or 7,000 miles away. A lot of our food comes from China. A lot of our food comes from parts of South America. A lot of it comes from Florida, depending on what you're growing. Most of the food, the greens in the United States, are grown in this desert state called California. This would seem on the surface to be a bad idea. Right beneath the surface, it's equally dry, and it's still a bad idea. Our food is grown on fields, a place I call Monsanto land. This place called Monsanto land is barren. It is not a place where food grows. It is a place with dead soil, shielding the mic, I'm not about to cough. It is a place with dead soil. The dead soil has to be fertilized. What do we use for fertilizer in America? We use a kind of oil. We use a kind of oil to fertilize our fields in America. Believe it or not, we use gas, natural gas, that comes out of oil wells, rises to the surface. We put that into a little box, we heat it, we compress it, we add hydrogen to it, and we get our ammonia, anhydrous ammonia, and we spray that oil byproduct of the oil industry, right on our fields. That's what we're eating. The nitrogen from natural gas is on your field. Oil is beginning to replace food as the most important thing in the world, for without oil, we wouldn't have any of the stuff that grows in the field, and that wouldn't then get into the animals that we eat that go onto our plates. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. We don't eat things that come from fields generally, unless we're weirdos or vegans or eat at a terrible place like Chipotle that dares try to serve us some non-GMO foods. Insane, I know, when the whole world should be fed on genetically modified products. At least that's what we're told is the truth by the advertisers who run the make-believe thing called the media. So we don't really eat that many vegetables unless you're on some sort of weirdo health food diet. What we eat instead is meat, because meat, it's what's for dinner, pork is what's for breakfast, bacon-wrapped, chocolate-drizzled, drenched pork cakes, pork pancakes, chocolate-flavored beef with chicken-sicles. Everybody knows that the more meat you eat, the healthier you are, the sooner that you die, and the more insurance the people around you get, because you better buy an insurance policy if you're an American and hope that it pays out. Meat is very important because, as you know, we only need a small amount of protein per day, and meat supplies 10 or 15 times that amount, the rest helping to provoke some sort of cancer-like reaction in the body. But don't worry, because the oil industry is there with helpful pharmaceuticals to take care of that problem. Meat grows in animals. Animals eat things that are grown in fields. Ah, back to the fields. They eat the anhydrous ammonium in the form of genetically modified corn and soybeans. They suck it down. They're too stupid to know the difference. Unlike human beings, who would never eat anything that was poisonous for them if it just tasted good and happened to be in front of them at a low, low price. The animals eat it, accruing many, many, many toxins. We put those on our plates, and that is what food is. But the animals don't walk to our house, especially when their heads have been cut off, so we need something else to bring it to us. Do you need to see the street again? There it is. There's the street. The street is full of trucks. There are about 26 million commercial trucks in the United States. 2.5 million of those are long-haul tractor trailers. Those long-haul tractor trailers carry everything we eat, drink, all of the pornography that you're busy looking at. Maybe I'm speaking for myself. All of the food that you eat and drink, all of the milk that comes to your house, the cows don't come to your house, squeeze their cancer-ridden, pox-ridden, hormone-infested udders into your food. No, somebody does it. A machine does it. A person plugs a machine onto a giant RGBH stuffed animal and puts that into a container, boils it, sends it to your grocery store on a truck. You drive your car to the grocery store and bring it home. Now, the circle of life is complete. We know where our food comes from. It comes from gasoline, which runs the trucks, natural gas, which feeds the fields. Why am I telling you this? What would happen if we built a system so dependent on one thing that we lost track of the fact that things don't walk themselves to our doors, having been slaughtered or butchered or suffused with enough chemicals to kill, well, all of the animals in America at once. And instead, we were reliant on one little thing, as though we had built a giant, giant city at the top of the tallest branch of the tallest tree that we could find. And the furthest, furthest branch, in the furthest reaches of that branch, we had built the heaviest city that could possibly have been built. And in that city we lived, and we had machines climbing up and down the trunk of the tree, climbing up and down the trunk to bring things from the ground where things grew. But we lived up in the city, and we never worried about where things came from because we had the machines that brought them to us. But those machines ran on a very special kind of nectar that we got by blowing holes in the earth. And one day it seemed harder to get that nectar out of the ground, and the holes had to be deeper and deeper, and we were getting less and less nectar, and we had to invent a thing called fracking to get more of the nectar out of the earth. There was a thing called the internet, and the internet was full of people saying the nectar will never run out, so you just kept going about your business, buying the things that came on the back of those machines, never worrying about where the food would come from because there was enough nectar in the earth to power the machines. And what if somebody went on the internet and said, actually, reading the oil reports, it looks like all of the countries in the world that used to produce a lot of nectar are producing less and less nectar since about 2005. And maybe we should relocate food either to the tree or maybe take the city out of the tallest, longest branch of the tallest tree and maybe relocate to the ground. Ha ha ha, said people on your Wall Street up there in the city. Innovation will rule the day. You'll never need to do anything but trust us. Trust the oil system, the nectar system. Trust that you'll never run out. Those of you who say that there are limits to things like resources, natural resources, are small-minded anti-American creeps, and you don't deserve to live in our city in the top of the tree. What's the most important thing in the world? I bet you could go a whole lifetime, as almost everybody on earth who ever lived has done, without that nectar of the ground called oil. I doubt you can go more than a few days without food. There is a solution to the problem. Nature will provide a solution. It will be called die-off or die-back. It has been well described by a number of people on web pages like dieoff.com. You can read many of the old peak oil sites to look at what historical die-offs and populations have looked like. Or you could take this land that I'm looking at that happens to be near the road and decide to reinvest it with that thing called food, which means you have to reinvest it with something called fertility. And fertility for land, you have to build a different kind of nectar, maybe the most important nectar in the world, the thing called soil. You don't know how to build soil? You get a lot of animals to eat a lot of other things that have died, like plants, which I know we don't eat, but you can feed them to animals, and maybe you could even feed it to the soil, and in a pinch, you could eat them yourself. I hear that it might prevent some diseases. Don't take my word for it, of course. This is a thought headed your way to warn you that the world is probably changing. And it is entirely possible that we, people on this swiftly changing planet, whether you believe it's flat, spherical, obloid, or any other thing, all eat food every day, or almost every day, if you're one of those fasting people. And we really might consider being a little more serious about knowing where our food came from. I would suggest it because I don't want to be cannibal food, and I don't want to have to become a cannibal. By the way, a good place to become a cannibal, Las Vegas. You're just going to have to cut around the breast implants. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. You can look up The Oil Alarm on YouTube. This is American Heretic. Put a couple dollars into the PayPal if you enjoy this message of ecological journalism. We are absolutely terrified of critical thinking. Critical thinking is the thing that we apply without religious devotion to any science or story that we have been introduced to in order to test it, to see if it stands up to, well, basic questions. Is it reproducible? Is it an object? Can I hold it in my hand? Is it three-dimensional? Is it a story? If so, what are the references for the story? Does the story have any precedence? If it's a science, can I test it and prove it? These are elements of critical thinking. Critical thinking is a very wide and in some ways undefinable, well, in some ways a boundaryless set of questions that you can apply to any particular story or object that you encounter. And we suck at it. We suck donkey balls. As a country, as a people, as a species, we suck donkey balls. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. You may not think that you suck donkey balls, but you do. You suck donkey balls at critical thinking. I'll stop saying that. You suck some kind of balls when it comes to critical thinking. You do. You do. Because as good as you are at critical thinking about vaccines, you're very religious. As good as you are at criticizing religion, you know science is true. And you accept no counter-argument to the contrary. You'll take no comers when it comes to the question of whether science is true, because science is science and science is true. And of course, religion has to be true on the other hand, because it is religion, and I was taught this when I was growing up. I find that we're terrified to embrace critical thinking when it comes to all fields. And it makes me an outlier. I mean, very much so. I'm very much on the outside. Because while I have a spiritual worldview, I don't subscribe to any particular religion, because religions are made up by people, and people are assholes. People are assholes with agendas. Their agendas tend to be to stay in power. People who control religions, like the people who ran the Roman Empire, who gave us many, many imperial pogroms, cleansings, taxations, weren't people who I trust with my inner emotional, spiritual life. The ancient Romans didn't know anything about, certainly the ancient Romans converting the world to Christianity by burning the libraries of the world, didn't know anything about spirituality. They wanted to make sure that the armies would worship the emperor as a god, and they put that whole thing in place. But very religious people who've grown up with the collected, assembled fables of the ancient Jews combined, which are stories of the ancient Babylonians, Assyrians, Sumerians, then put into some sort of fluffy quiche with the Egyptian rising and dying gods, with a little Mithras thrown in and a little undercoating of Dionysus in there, plus the semi-spiritual Gnostic movements of, well, Egypt, the ancient Near East. We've decided that all of this is true and is not subject to critical thinking. Unless, of course, you're very scientific, in which case you can be very critical about religious thinking to a degree. But even the very scientific people are kind of afraid to really look at Mother Church and say, aren't you a late Roman fabrication meant to manage the pockets and the war interests of the population? If so, can I just not have my own idea of a spiritual universe? We're afraid to apply critical thinking equally from the people who are absolutely adoring of science to the people who are absolutely adoring of religion. And it creates a huge donkey ball problem in America and the rest of Europe and everywhere in the world. Everywhere in the world where these battling, hypocritical, fable-ridden devices come along, one called absolute pure science and one called absolutely true-ish, we believe, we have faith, don't ask us any questions, religion, they turn people into idiots and morons. A total absolute belief in any system that you're afraid to test turns you into a moron. An idiot. You're a dupe. You're playing a dupe. I absolutely believe you. You have my faith. I believe you because I don't believe religion. I believe you, science, because I don't believe religion. You can make, therefore, ergo, everybody who is critical of vaccines is a criminal and is anti-science, and anti-science is the same as anti-truth. On the other hand, I believe because I have faith, because I was taught in a way that there was a magical Jew who did magical things. I don't really read the books because the books are very hard to read and don't make a lot of sense, and they sort of suck the faith right out of me, actually, when I actually read the books, because the books are crazy. Jeez, have you read these books? They're crazy. The sex and the fin and the mothers and the fathers and the salts and the murder of all those people and all of that violent circumcision. Rape, rape, rape. Murder, murder, murder. These books are crazy. Oh, but I have faith. I have faith. Actually, part two, the sequel, was supposed to erase all that bad stuff, so part two's cool until he comes back with a flaming sword coming out of his mouth. But that's just for the some people who believe it. I believe in the Jesus who's nice. I believe in the Krishna who's nice, the nice Krishna Jesus guy. I believe in the Allah who's very, very nice, not the mean Allah who does want us to all create, religious war against the people who aren't with us. There, on the other hand, though, you have the religious people who say, if you don't get vaccinated, we'll take away your children. I mean, they'll actually do it. They'll actually take away your children. If you don't give them this terrible, terrible life-ending drug, this AIDS drug, cancer drug, given that we don't know really anything about biology when we're talking about AIDS and cancer, we just sort of make it up and keep the thing stringing along, funding it to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars while we kill people, leave bodies in our wake, and claim victory for every dead person that we get. Because we save their lives by not ending their life as quickly as we might think that we would have ended their life if we had given them last year's drug, which was actually so poisonous that it killed people so quickly that this year's drug is definitely saving their lives. If you're in that camp of religion, you're an asshole. But if you're in that camp of religion, you're actually practicing eugenics. So people on the other hand, religion, the Jesus Allah Krishna religion, have to say, I gotta believe in this, because didn't Jesus say something about being nice? Not really. You got to read the books, but don't read the books because the books will drive you crazy. If your critical thinking clicks in, and it will, you won't be able to help it, because when we encounter the actual words of things that people wrote down, we can't help but, like somebody doing a tax form and going, this doesn't make any fucking sense at all. They're just stealing from us. All right, fine, here's my money, render unto Caesar, all that kind of stuff. You know critically inside when you're being absolutely lied to. When you take the time to get beyond the words flying through the air, government's your friend, vote for Bernery. Doesn't matter who you vote for, as long as you vote. Voting is good. They're wasting your time. Voting doesn't matter. Voting doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. They're going to do what they want to do. It's all an oil state. Don't you get it? Invest in your local community. Don't listen to those people saying invest in your local communities. They're communards. Don't do that. Haven't you read about the Paris Commune? It didn't end well. Don't do it. We don't apply critical thinking equally across the spectrum. If we did, we would not be afraid to say that Christianity was some bizarro world, late Roman confabulation of every religion that came before it. We wouldn't be afraid to say it. We wouldn't have to think that some magical Jew came down and then went back and is coming again with the flaming sword and putting everybody in hawk for a while, or if you believe him at the time, I guess you'll be okay. Maybe. When do you have to convert? I'm not sure. What's the time schedule? Kirk Cameron knows. And then the devil goes to jail for 1,000 years, but that story isn't true. At least we don't believe it. We're reformed. We kind of believe to be nice to each other, Christmas, Xbox, etc., etc., all those holidays. That's what it's all about, isn't it? More oil for more Xbox. Happy Christmas. Here's a chocolate egg. It's the rebirth of spring. Ah! Do you have peanut butter stuffed chocolate eggs? Because then I can get behind that a little bit, maybe. If you apply critical thinking to the insane world that both religion and science have built, right, then what do? Because then you have to pick very carefully from among the ruins. And you look at religion,
Any religion that's been powerful enough, by the way, to take over the world is just politics. And you can quote me on that. One more time, any religion that's been powerful enough to take over the world is just politics. God, that's pretty good. I should write a book called that, something like that. Any religion that's been powerful enough to take over the world works on the level of psychology to shame you, to make you terrified, to get you to be afraid that if you don't do what it says, you're going to a bad place. It's not spiritually uplifting unless you give in to all the old fear. Oh my God, I got a little turned on. I must be a terrible person. Forgive me, Father. I was at work and somebody's skirt went like this and I got excited. Here's money. Here you go. I'll ask you no questions. I'm sure nothing bad can happen if I just put all you guys in charge. On the other hand, if you've all grown up and you've decided you're an atheist or very agnostic, and you know that religion's probably not true, but you're not going to bang on it too much because it's very powerful and you don't want to make enemies, still, you know, it's probably myth, but you don't know because there are some moral guideposts in it, just like there are moral guidelines in any book that's ever been written by anybody, ever, any book, any book. Any book is as good as the Bible. Any book ever is as good as the Bible as a moral guidepost. For all the shit you have to ignore in the Bible to find the moral guiding points. Well, we'll leave out the part about the raping and murdering and ethnic cleansing for God. Yeah. Just take Dickens. Just take Dickens. You don't have to leave all that stuff out. The moral guidelines are there. Take Austin. Very nice. Girls will get long-suffering guys who really learn to speak their language. It's the Jane Austen world. It's nice. It's okay. It's not real. We don't allow ourselves to think critically across the board. If you do, you have to be an outlier. You have to sit on the outside, looking in, going, yeah, this world's pretty butternut fucking squash crazy. None of you are making sense. The most important things in the world, from the basic viewpoint of thermodynamics, of energy use, our food and water are the most important things in the world. And what are we doing to those? That's the most important thing in the world. Food and water. And what are we doing to those? We don't ask that question. Instead, we're worried about, well, I don't know, who's having sex with who and who's getting a divorce from who, because religion has suppressed our natural, normal, rather carefree, flirtatious nature and made it a grievous mortal sin to ever get turned on by anybody except the person that you are mutually enslaved, devoted to only favor them, or you must kill yourselves in divorce court for some reason. Oh my God, I looked at somebody at work, I've sinned. Oh my God, they've got you running around in such circles. And then you go to government to get permission to do that and then to break up. They've got us running around in every circle they want because we're afraid to just ask the questions. What is history? What are people really? What's the most important thing in the world? Anybody who can get us to believe a story that we have no evidence for at all. Most of the sciences, all of the religions, very little good evidence. Anybody who can get us to believe that by believing these we're somehow either a good person or a bad person is a fucking asshole. And it's a group of assholes. It's institutionalized assholism. And we shouldn't give in to institutionalized assholism. We should give in to holism. We should decide to integrate. If we're going to be whole people, we should decide to integrate and say we apply critical thinking. We're not going to be atheists because it's impossible to prove that the universe is not spiritually alive and awake. It's impossible to prove that the universe is not spiritually alive and awake. In fact, all of the reasonable evidence says that the universe is spiritually alive and awake because we're here. We're almost evidence that the universe manifests us to look at the universe, to look at itself. You could say the universe is slightly narcissistic or just very curious. Maybe the universe wants to interact with itself. There's an old Taoist Hindu idea put forward without all the accompanying need to worship all the gods in the various days and sacrifice this, that, and the other to Allah, Buddha, Yahweh, Trump. My name is Liam Sheff. This is a rather discursive and somewhat rambling version of a video called American Heretic. My book is Official Stories. I'm working on my new book, Slowly But Surely. You can buy Official Stories online. You can put a couple dollars into the PayPal. I don't see anybody out there who's willing to be as integrative as I am. I don't meet integrative people. Everybody's got their bias against one group or another, instead of just saying, we'll apply critical thinking to it. First, America has a concept of sex that only Sigmund Freud could love. We are told that there are two genders and two sexes. This sounds logical, but there are very few peoples of the world historically who would have understood that to be correct. There has never been a perfect culture, so those of you at Collective Evolution looking for the example of that perfect culture that did it all right can keep typing. That said, most cultures throughout human history have understood the variety of sexual expression and gender expression, that there's some fluidity, that there, to quote one of the Native American ideas, there are men with men's souls, and women with women's souls, and women with men's souls, and men with women's souls. And just in that little four-part diagram, you can understand life so much more complexly than you can in the marble or man and please shut up and bake me a pie woman. Very few people are comfortable in those roles. I don't really know anybody who's entirely comfortable in those roles, even if they bear a superficial passing resemblance on the outside. So let's first dispense with the idea of an American sense of gender identity. It doesn't really exist. To make it more interesting and more fluid, let's talk about yin and yang, the masculine and feminine energies of the universe, not the male and the female, not just the lingam and the yoni, to talk about it that way, but the actual male and female essences, that of action, of heat, of penetration, that of coolness, of damp, of acceptance and fertility, that these things exist in varying quantities and qualities at various levels in both men and women. Therefore, men can be nurturing and loving, and women can be driving and business-oriented and, you know, horrible monsters, just like men. We see that when we see women running for office, for example, they instinctively take on the patterned behavior of what we consider to be men, but is really the yang characteristic of driving, having no sympathy or empathy. That's why Hillary Clinton took out her, you know, huge wang and said that she would drop a nuclear bomb on anybody who gave a dirty look at the falafel factory or something. I think Israel, you know, don't look at them dirty or I'll kill you, we'll kill you all, you know, because she is hyper exaggerating her masculine, her yang energy so that she can appeal to what she considers Americans. I'm sure she didn't always have these opinions. Once upon a time when she was a person, she probably recognized the female soul within herself as well. That's, of course, long dead. That's a different story. Brave. So are we brave in America when we, instead of accepting a little bit of gender fluidity inside of the vessels that the Lord Krishna, Vishnu, and Shiva, that's what I'm going with. I don't have a right to say that. Fuck off. The Lords Krishna, Vishnu, and Shiva, and Brahma have given us. It's a free country, isn't it? I'm allowed to. The Lords of the universe, the creators of all, Starbuck and Apollo, whatever you believe is out there, manifest us. We manifest out of, and we are in these forms. Imperfect, too fuzzy, not enough hair here, too much hair, problems everywhere. Here we are. This is what we are. Now, if I have a very female day, a very feminine day, and I just feel like curling up and watching a lot of Sex and the City, do I have to call Bruce and find his doctor and get Botox? Or can I just watch Sex and the City? I enjoy Sex and the City. Does Hillary Clinton enjoy Sex and the City? Probably not anymore. I picture her to be kind of a Samantha, but with a larger penis. Sorry, off topic. Brave. Are we brave in America for being surgical about our misunderstanding of gender identity? Damn it. So when Bruce comes out, painted, still wanting to have sex with girls, still with his penis, wanting to be a girl. Does it have to be brave? Couldn't it have been a little more private? Isn't the fun to be had in his own life? It is a him, by the way, not a her. And no matter what you do, even if you cut something off or tie something on, the biology screaming on the inside will be him. Now, Americans will say, no, what if he identifies as a her on the inside? You're not listening to what I'm saying. We all identify as a her on the inside. I can imagine what it's like to be a girl and enjoy I'm not going to be able to get through this. I can imagine what it's like to be a girl and enjoy a good throttling with a big, hefty I'm trying. I can imagine. Maybe it's not, but I can imagine. All right, maybe I just lost the audience on that one. Oh, this was going so well. I can imagine what it's like to be in my female self. I can imagine what it's like to be a very aggressive male. I'm not a very aggressive male. I'm a male. I'm somewhere on the in-betweens. I can imagine, but I do have a very strong female self. I have a very loving, compassionate self. I have such a caring self that I've sometimes, I swear, gotten into relationships because I was worried about somebody, you know? I wasn't even looking after my own well-being. They call that codependence sometimes. But what I'm saying is, don't we all have a female soul and a male soul? Don't we all have a part of us that is in the feminine and a part, excuse me, that's in the masculine? I'm overly caffeinated. All right. We'll be right back. A friend of mine once said that when she got married, she was very happy, but then she became sad realizing she would never have a first kiss again. I think she's now reconsidering that and thinking that life may be a more open prospect. I won't speak for her, I'll speak for myself. I think it's possible to have the excitement of first kisses throughout life if you remember that you're human, that the Christian church is an invention of the mind of the Roman Empire, that people had never been monogamous so much as they've been tribal, and quite loyal to their tribe, by the way, and that we are, by nature, a flirtatious, affectionate species. If you can remember those things, including that loyalty concept to tribe, I think that you can enjoy yourself your whole life long if you are a grown-up. Now, in America, being a grown-up almost doesn't exist. You have to be so far on the outside of what's considered to be a good American to be a grown-up. Well, that's what we're going to talk about. My name's Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. My other book is The Truth About Love. I'm working on my third book right now. This is American Heretic, funded by you. If you like what you hear or it raises interesting questions in your mind, put a couple dollars into the PayPal to thank me for sharing the thoughts with you. Now, when I was young, as I've said in previous episodes, I went through what is in the Guinness Book of World Records recorded as the most bloody, needlessly violent divorce of 1973 through 9. So I know of what I speak when I speak of people not getting along and not being grown up enough to just talk about it. I know of what I speak when I say it's not a good idea to run to the lawyers to let them sort it out for you, because you really will be left with nothing but a shitty apartment and nobody to share it with, and a total lack of love and a feeling that you're unloved, either as a woman or as the child, and as a father you'll probably feel like a total failure if you give in to the American system of divorce. If you're not getting along in a relationship, or even if you are, there are options available to you that are not discussed, that are not written to you, that are not there in the marriage contract, which asks a woman to be bonnie at bed and at board, but asks a man simply to come home once in a while and throw a little bit of money on the table so there's food in the pot. The roles of marriage have always been defined medievally, and they are pretty Old Testament in quality and character. In the 70s, when my parents were divorced, you know, concepts of women's liberation were really just coming into the mainstream. Alan Alda had not yet become a woman on the show MASH. He was still being something of a male. But at one point he did eventually cross over. I love Alan Alda. I'm just teasing. Alan Alda, by the way, was my adopted TV dad, because he resembles my dad, and I always appreciated seeing him there. Media does some good things. He was actually a good role model. He was so communicative. But the idea that women had rights was, you know, it was still pretty dark ages in the 70s. And divorce, which was now accepted, was going to be bloody. Yes, there will be blood. That's what was understood about divorce in America. There are other ways to go about divorce. I've talked a little about those. But there are also ways to have exciting lives that don't require you to have a divorce. Most people's marriages are okay. They get through that early romantic period having, you know, squeezed a lot of juice out of the lemons and limes and enjoyed it. And by squeezing a lot of juice, they end up with a kid or two or three. And that changes everything, because you're now not carefree. Your life is spent cleaning and working. working at a job to make money to make sure there's stuff to put in the pot at the end of the day, and we're back in that old medieval relationship. Men have always had people on the side. Women have fantasies, fantasy books, pen pal, you know, lovers. The most brazen women occasionally take a lover. The women with the most sort of almost egotistically independent mind that says, look, I'm not going to die in this shell. I'm going to have a little bit of fun on the side. Now, if you think that that's totally abysmal, you should look at the Maasai tribe. They treat their women like animals. But the women, many or even most of the women, depending on who you read, have special friends because the husbands are so bad to them. They want somebody to talk pretty with, dirty, romantic, somebody to read a little poetry to them. It seems to be part of the human experience to want people to be nice to you and to have sensual experiences, if not totally sexual, with people who you enjoy. The idea then that we're going to have one person who we've gotten into this long-term relationship of providing for other people that's always romantic is the great American delusion. And we all feel like failures at it because we're programmed to be failures. People Magazine, us, In Touch, they're all there to mock the lives of others. We look at Jen and Ben and anybody else, you know, on the cover from week to week, telling us how they're failing, and then we can feel that schadenfreude, happiness at their failure. But the same titillation at, well, they're doing it, so maybe we can too, but look what happened to them, they're being shamed, so we better not do it. But, on the other hand, let's read all about it and get all the juicy details to live a little bit vicariously through their genital activity, which may be falsely reported or may be true. Who knows? Depends on what you believe, if you believe what you read. Is it possible, though, to keep a little bit of romance in your relationship once you have all that responsibility? That's a question that people have made millions and millions of dollars pretending to answer. Oh, yes, spice it up. You know, bring in handcuffs. Feed each other chocolate cake in bed. You know, put a little chocolate on his wang. You know, something like that. Do a little bit of spicing it up. That can be fun. Nevertheless, the kids might burst in and you might have all kinds of responsibilities the next day. And it's sort of hard to get back to a romantic place when you're knee-deep in bills, mortgages, you know, the constant onslaught of the petrochemical pharmaceutical state. You may just be surviving in the lifeboat together, and you may be grateful that you're just both there to help ease the pain sometimes. The sex drive may just be exhausted. However, you may get excited by other people that you meet. Now, this is where we run into problems in America, because it is absolutely forbidden in America to be excited by other people that you meet. And it is, of course, a problem to be excited by other people you meet because you get involved with them at some level and it's not going to be perfect. And you'll find very quickly, once you liberate yourself from the American marriage structure and you talk with your partner about being allowed to flirt a little, you realize that even the people that you get to meet, you'll have a relationship with, which means you'll get along sometimes and sometimes you won't. And that's a little bit of extra pressure. On the other hand, it's another outlet. It's another person to talk to. It's another person to be supportive in case of emergency. Unfortunately, in America, we think that if you're with somebody, but you also like somebody else, you have to choose. You have to choose to leave somebody that you're quite good with. I said most marriages are okay, and you're quite okay at home. And by the way, if you left this person for this person, you actually left them, split everything in two, lit it on fire, threw the kids to the winds, and went with this person, and tried to do it all over again, pretty soon you would just be okay. And you'd be looking for that little bit of spark. Now, psychologists have made this some sort of narcissistic a deficit in you, that you want some spark in your life. Can you imagine? They've actually convinced people that it is some sort of mental problem to want a little bit of romance or excitement in your life. On the contrary, the mental illness is that you have to murder one relationship to enjoy a little bit of another. Or that you couldn't be reasonably honest with both people and say, look, I have a partner, I'm not leaving my partner, but if you want to talk dirty, or tell me what you're into, or simply be my friend and listen to me, or if you'd like to hug and kiss or even fool around a little bit, as long as you don't think that you own me and you're not going to become one of those people and you remain my friend. And then you can go to your primary partner and say, look, I want you and I to be grown-ups and to figure out what our priorities are. I want to be able to be your friend for the next foreseeable future because we have all these kids together and we do so many things well. I know we forget it because we're so busy and we forget to compliment each other because, you know, dinner wasn't on time and something got fucked up at the garage and so we don't have the extra car that we need right now and everybody's stressed. But we actually do a lot of things really well together and we forget to thank each other for that. And one of the reasons we forget to thank each other for that is because we're so wound up in thinking that if we're not totally perfect with each other, then we have to get a divorce. But what if we didn't actually have to get a divorce if we weren't totally perfect, and we got to flirt a little on the outside? And you could go fool around a little bit here and there if you really wanted to. Just blow off some steam. It's fine. Have another friend to lean on so you're not such a grumpy puss all the time. Have another friend to lean on so you're not, you don't get so fucking purity and bitchy sometimes. Just find somebody else to lean on sometimes to blow off a little steam and to listen to you. I know it's unfair that I said purity, but men get on their periods too. Sorry, I can't dig my way out of that. Write your angry letters here. Liam, it was unfair. I was with you all the way until you said we get purity. You do get purity. You do. You do. So do men. Men get purity. We just don't actually bleed, but we do get weird. Men do get emotional, and we say we need time in the man cave. We don't need time in the man cave. We need time out to go and flirt and hang out with guys and girls and remember what it's like to be young at heart and young in spirit. And you know what? Women need the same fucking thing. Now I hear the alleluias and amens. We all need the same thing, to get out and remember what it's like to be a person again, not just a reflection for one person's set of psychological needs. You know, I don't like the way you do this. I don't like the way you do that. Please stop. You're driving me crazy. Nobody wants to be badgered all the time, but we do get on each other's nerves, so we try to minimize that by stopping doing the things that get on each other's nerves, and pretty soon we're in a tighter and tighter and tighter, tighter, little tiny umbilical sac, and nobody can touch us, and we can't touch anybody else because we're afraid that if we do look outside of the little tiny umbilical sac, the two-person tiny lifeboat that seems to be getting smaller every day, we have to murder, suicide ourselves in a divorce. I'm not talking about couples that beat each other up physically, in which one person is a psychotic, sociopathic narcissist or something like that. You know, run. Go get a divorce. Fine. But besides that, or even if a narcissistic person could be convinced, hey, you don't have to be so narcissistic. If you want to go have a little fun, have a little fun. I'm going to have a little fun too, and we're going to remain loyal to the people in life but with us, namely the children. Make sure that they're fed, make sure they're clothed, make sure they're going to a good school, or we're homeschooling them well. Make sure we're not being total fucking cunty assholes, so their model of adult life isn't cunty assholdom. Now, you say, but aren't we supposed to stay together for the children? Well, there's another option. Instead of staying together for the children, thinking that lying to them all the time and being an example of duplicity and you know, fake painted smiles and unhappiness is what they really need, perhaps you could be adults. It's hard to do, and I'm not mocking it, but you could be adults and say, hey, kids, mom and dad really are friends. We are always going to be wonderful, supportive friends, and you're never going to have anything to worry about. We're going to communicate with each other, and we are your parents, no matter what. But the Catholic Church, the Christian Church, the Jewish Church, and the Muslim Hindu Church is not right about everything. And we are more tribal than that. We have other friends who we get along with and we'll hang out with sometimes. And you might meet them sometimes if they're really good people. And you might not. But that's what we are. Do you really hear any arguments? Like, what did you say? You're not leaving us. We're going to be supported. We're going to have a network of people who we can trust. We're going to have a network of good people who we can trust. Now, rather than keeping it all hidden on the side, on the DL, on the down low, you know, when you're on the down low and sneaking, you're not going to find the best people. You're going to find other people who are sneaking and feeling bad about it. But if you're up front and saying, yeah, actually, I'm allowed to go on a date here and there. Yeah, I'm married, but I'm allowed to go have a little fun now and then. I'm not getting a divorce. I'm not leaving my kids. So you can forget about that, but I can go have a little fun. I can have a friend who listens to me. If you're able to do that, what kind of person are you going to attract? An open-minded person? A self-aware person? A self-conscious person? A person who has consciousness? Wow, what a nightmare. Yeah. In America, we live in a self-retarding, brain-damaged conceptualization that comes out of a total misunderstanding of what they weren't doing in medieval Europe. It was never the way that we do it now. The Hallmark holiday with the handcuffs on it going, I love you forever, I'll never look outside, or I deserve to be killed in public on Oprah. Bullshit. Bullshit. We all want the same thing. We want security and stability, but we also want to be alive. And if you really are a grown-up, if you're really a grown-up, it might be possible to figure out, with due consideration and conversation, how to do both. You're going to have to work at it. There is no template out there, and you're going to have to break free from the mooing herd of cows and sheep. Ah, oh, it's wrong. Jesus said so. Jesus didn't say anything. Don't worry about it. You be good to people. You figure out how to be honest. You figure out how to be kind. There you are. There you're living any message of goodness that you ever thought you were told to live. You don't have to keep it together for the children. Maybe you should learn to be an honest, caring person who values a certain level of stability for the children. Maybe then you can have the excitement of a first kiss from time to time through life as you meet interesting people, but not sacrifice the kids and the stable relationship along the way. I know there are unintended consequences. I know some people will get very close. There is something called new relationship energy, which means when you find somebody you really groove with, you really groove with them, and you get more excited about life than you've been for a long time. You have to make sure to keep that a little bit in context, because it'll pass and you'll be friends after a while. It really will. You'll be like good friends, but you'll be friends. Somebody will say the wrong thing. You're like, oh, they're just a person, but they're a cool person, but they're just a person. It always happens. And that's good, because it allows us to be friends with a lot of people over a long period of time. My name's Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories and the Truth About Love. I'm working on my new book. You can support the writing of that book by putting a couple dollars into the PayPal. Thank you so much. This is American Heretic. Something you don't hear people talk about very much in the alternative media as a point of criticism is video games. I don't know that there might be some, but many op-eds about video games on the Huffington Post, there certainly are, about transgendered CO2 causing global warming or not causing global warming or something like that. I want to talk about video games. My name is Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. This is American Heretic. I grew up, I was born in 1971. I'm 45 in a couple of days. I grew up without video games and then grew up with video games. It happened when I was about nine. I suppose the Atari came out and was kind of big, but only some people had it. You had to go to your friend's house to play what looked like blocks moving around, and you'd get tired of it after a while. Yeah, and then came, well, the next generation, and everybody remembers the names, you know, with a little bit of excitement in television. And then I think Coleco, and then the next Atari. And then I sort of aged out. Then there was the Sega Genesis, then I aged out of it. I actually had aged out of it a long time before that. Now my mother, for making a lot of mistakes when I grew up, doing a lot of things that I wish she hadn't done, did a couple things that were really good. She thought that video games were a waste of time and a waste of creative talent and intelligence. She wasn't wrong. All mothers around the world watching this go, yes, don't worry, I'll get there. So instead of giving me a video game, she got me a computer that could play video games, but not very good ones that were cool. Instead, I learned to program at 12 or something like that in BASIC and extended BASIC, just elementary logic-based computer languages. And I learned essentially syllogisms, if then, you know, if A equals B, then C. If A doesn't equal B, then, you know, not C. Or you would play around with the logical constructions, and you could make things happen. I suppose that had some value. And maybe, you know, if I have a love of logic, maybe it was given some reinforcement there. Nevertheless, I aged out of that. I didn't want to do that anymore. And I, you know, got into life as it was lived. Video games are now so popular and so ubiquitous that all people play them. People standing on subways and driving in their cars play Candy Crush Mountain and all the other forms of Tetris that exist these days. People play Farmville for hours on, for days, for weeks, for years on Facebook. I'd like to explain why I think video games are harmful and dangerous, while admitting that I suppose they're fun and distracting. It is perhaps because they're fun and distracting that they're most harmful and dangerous. For if they were fun and distracting but not addictive, then we wouldn't really care. Or if they were harmful and dangerous but not fun, we wouldn't care because nobody would do them. But they hit that sweet spot, don't they, of distraction, of removing your mind from your body. I'm sure that somebody could do a study and realize that video games help your mind tune into a meditative state, but you're not meditating. You're instead focused on what somebody in some other country in some video game laboratory and some computer science laboratory devised for you. It's a mental trap that they made, a maze in faux three dimensions and two dimensions that you can't quite get out of because we're problem solvers. As a species, we're problem solvers, we're tool makers, and video games put us into a place where we think we're solving problems, we think we're getting out of mazes, we think we're making tools or using tools, but we're not. Here's what we're doing. Now, this skill is not transferable to anything else in life. If you are the best at a video game, that is the end of your ability to use that set of skills, except maybe a similar video game. But if you're very good at the piano, for example, or even if you work very hard at being good at the piano, that set of skills carries on to all musical instruments. It not only carries on to that, but it carries to logic, it carries to meditative qualities, it carries to an appreciation of mathematics, to the music of the spheres, to visualization of abstraction, to the ability to communicate more clearly. I mean, you can look at studies of young people who are studying music. Their art skills increase, their language skills can often increase, and their mathematical skills certainly increase. You also do something that other people can enjoy, rather than solipsistically and narcissistically being involved in a little slave box that somebody else, who's frankly a slave in another country, working at some terrible, terrible job, programming this slave box for you to live inside of, to pay $50, $60, $70 for this disc, or whatever they come on now, to put into this $300, $400 machine. So, and then you have to pay $70 more for the controller that's ergonomically appropriate for the game, over and over again. The thousands of dollars are mounting. What are you good at? What skills do you have? What can you do? When I was a kid, I didn't play a lot of video games. My mother wouldn't really let me. I learned to whittle. I can carve. I molded clay. I can paint. I learned to cook at an elementary... Well, I learned to cook, actually, when I was a teenager and a child. I learned to bake and then to cook. I learned all kinds of things. I certainly read a lot. And I listened to the equivalent of books on tapes or records or that sort of thing. And I listened to a lot of music. Eventually, I played piano a little bit, but I resisted it because of the way that they taught. That's really a lesson for another time. You shouldn't teach kids to play piano by making them read notes. They have to do it kinesthetically. You have to put your hands on the piano and learn chords in the circle of fifths and be able to make music just by, you know, knowing the topography of the instrument. That's another story, but it is related. When I was in my 20s and I was away from everything and I was very bored, I finally gave in a little bit and I played some video games, and they were as much stressing as they were de-stressing. You would be caught in these endless loops that had no out, and then you would accomplish something, you know, and I realized I didn't get a date because of this. The girl that I like doesn't like me because I beat the boss at the end of the level. I have no real-world skills. I don't know the poems of Rambo. I didn't memorize a sonnet of Shakespeare. I'm not in the least bit more impressive than I was. I didn't learn a martial art by playing a martial arts video game. I learned martial arts to the degree that I know them by going and making myself take martial arts in my 20s. I didn't grow up with a father who was really a suitable parent. And, you know, besides teaching me that it's not okay to hit your kids, and by the way, if you're a parent who thinks it's okay to hit your kids, trust me, it's not. Time out is much more effective. If you ever feel like hitting a child, give yourself one really good slap, maybe closed fist slap across the face first, just to let yourself know what the kid is in for, and then see if you still feel like doing it. So I grew up with a father who really wasn't a very good father, even though he had a high position and was respected and that sort of thing. He was a really bad father. So I didn't get to do or learn the things I wanted to do. And in my 20s, I think I bemoaned that. And there's the whole, is it Leo Buscaglio, you know, mourn all those stuff that the inner child didn't get and cry. Well, at some point you go, okay, I'm not dead yet. Fuck, I'm going to go take martial arts. I can do it. I'll be my own good parent. So I went and I did that. I didn't learn that by playing a video game. Video games will entrap you in a world. They will cost you thousands of dollars and you won't be good at anything. You won't actually be good at anything. I would prefer that you gave children, kids, a buck knife and a piece of wood and let them whittle. trust them not to carve themselves to pieces, because they won't unless they're on psychotropic medications, you know, from the Prozac people. If your kid is having behavioral problems, consider changing their diet to something that resembles a Whole Foods. And I don't mean the disgusting store. I mean a Whole Foods diet, full of good grains, vegetables, meats, so if you want to eat that kind of thing, good fats, low in the food chain, fish, all that kind of stuff. Really make their nervous system happy, and then let them be people again. Let them use clay and wood and a knife. Let them learn how to carve something so they can eventually make a joint, a dovetail joint or a jointed structure, so eventually we can learn to build structures and houses together again. Let them have time with a piano or a guitar and learn the discipline of making their body do something over and over again that has some value, that has a mathematical, artistic, soothing, meditative value. I think video games are terribly, terribly, terribly insidious because we're told that they're fun. They're not fun. They're profoundly addictive. They hook us into the illusion that we're getting things done, that we're accomplishing something, and all that we accomplish. And there are 45-year-olds, I'm 45, sitting at home playing, I don't know what they play, Call of Duty or World of War, I don't even know what the new ones are, but you understand what I'm saying. They spend thousands of dollars, thousands, thousands and thousands of dollars on home entertainment systems so that they can live in a world that has no value, that is a slave world created by slaves so that we're all enslaved looking at non-reality. See you next time. This is the Liam Sheff Show on UCY TV, Truth Frequency Radio. Please support the show by buying official stories at Amazon. We'll be right back. there are people who believe that planet Earth was once part of a different solar system, a much smaller solar system that went around a much smaller sun, and in fact was in the cocoon, the envelope, of a much smaller sun, and was entirely enveloped by that cocoon, so it couldn't see out the way that we can see out into space. That sun was called Saturn. There were our brother planets Mars and perhaps Mercury, others, going around that small solar system of the Saturn protostar. One day, goes the story, the Saturn solar system, encased in its glow, came into contact with a much larger, more powerful solar system, and the electromagnetic energy was stripped by the larger star, the larger electromagnet in that solar system, and Saturn lost its glow. And in losing its glow, it had to shed a lot of energy, and in shedding energy, it had to spill out a lot of its guts to minimize its size and strength and ability to attract. And in that calamity, goes the people who believe this, was born the modern world. Earth was stripped off, electromagnetically captured by the larger star, our current sun, and Saturn gained a place in the middle outer solar system, going around its new star, our current star. Venus was an ejecta, a powerful flaming ejecta from the guts of the Saturn protostar, again in order to balance its electromagnetic load. Venus and Mars and Earth performed a kind of celestial tango, moving around in their elliptical orbits, getting sometimes passing close to each other, and in that closeness, their electromagnetic envelopes touching, discharging massive plasma rays to each other and carving up the face of Mars. Venus was superheated because it was an ejecta of a star, Saturn, and Earth was scarred in some areas, perhaps the seas, certainly the Grand Canyon. Mars was carved deep in the Valles Marineris, 5 miles deep, whereas our Grand Canyon is only a mile deep, but very similar to the Grand Canyon in that there's no river system there, and there never was. Similar to our Grand Canyon in that there was no river system that carved it. The Colorado River just follows the hole that was left. This may sound entirely crazy, and maybe it is, but I'd like to talk about it a little because it's interesting. My name's Liam Sheff. My book is Official Stories. You can read about Electric Universe Concepts in Chapter 9 of my book. You can also visit Walt Thornhill's page. I'll be talking about him at holoscience.com. You can put a couple dollars into the PayPal to support this message of independent science journalism. Or, if you want to consider it fantasy or myth, that's fine too. Now, this idea sounds absolutely bonkers. How is it that Saturn could have been a star? It seems bonkers until you look at current astronomy. And current astronomy has now figured out that the majority of stars looking out there into space in our galaxy and in others are what are called brown dwarfs and red dwarf stars. These are very low glow stars. They have low temperature. There are brown dwarf stars that are not much more than body temperature on top. I mean, a little more, 110 degrees, 120 degrees on the surface, maybe even a little bit cooler. I'm talking about a star. I didn't say 110,000 degrees. 110 degrees, but it's a star, it's glowing, it's a plasma, it's glowing. How is that possible? Very interesting. Astronomers now look into space and they see low glow stars. Now look at Saturn, this protoplanetary star, this protostar that is now a gas giant planet. You look on its north and south poles and they're very hot. And they glow. They have very strong auroral glow. There's actually a hexagonal pattern on the poles because of the currents, the electromagnetic currents pouring in from the local solar system. The planets that go around Saturn and Jupiter go around and pass through this massive electromagnetic field that loops out from the planet like a figure eight on both sides, like the Van Allen radiation belts. Saturns are much stronger. And Io and some of the other planets, we call moons, which are really planets, going around in this solar system of Saturn are moving through like a coil in an electromagnetic motor, like a what's called a Faraday motor, after Michael Faraday, great, was he Scottish? Inventor who really pioneered a lot of what is now known about electricity simply by doing experiments, writing it down. He didn't have to seek peer review. He just did the experiments and demonstrated it. So a Faraday motor is a is a wheel that goes through an electromagnet, and the electromagnetic brushes it. Nikola Tesla's great innovation was to say the brush, the electromagnetic brush, doesn't actually have to touch the wheel, so it can be much faster and stronger. So there's a tiny history of electromagnetism and research into how we make electricity now. The Tesla wheel is boom, 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 but the Faraday motor actually brushed and touched. And it, by doing so, it conducted a charge from magnet to electromagnetic wheel, metal wheel, that would generate a charge. Well, Saturn's moons go around and, like the metal of the wheel, go through Saturn's electromagnetic figure eight, its shell, its magnetosphere. We have one too. And it generates a charge, and so they burst into flames. There are flames all over these moons that NASA astronomers want to say are volcanoes. But the volcanoes move, you know, dozens and dozens of miles. I don't think volcanoes move dozens and dozens of miles. Then there are sparks that shoot out from the surface, and there are glows in areas that they just can't predict. So they have all these ad hoc, you know, inventions of why they're glowing in certain places, but they don't know because they don't want to say it's electromagnetic out there. Saturn is so electromagnetically charged, as is Jupiter, with its electromagnetic storms that are thousands of Earths, you know, in diameter, that go on for decades, that go on and on and on. A giant electromagnetic storm, the size of many, 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 many planet Earths. Imagine that. This is all electromagnetic. These planets have inordinate, Jupiter has unexpected speed, and Saturn has unexpected heat. These gas giants then look very much like these brown dwarf stars, but these gas giant planets are in the greater cocoon of our star, and our star is so much larger and so much more powerful and electromagnetic pinch that it's just stripping the material of the entire solar circuit away from these late additions, Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus, Eurectum. Sorry. There are other ideas that would make you think that the planets in our solar system weren't where they always are, aren't where they always were. They have something called an axial tilt. And Earth and, I want to say, Mars and Saturn all are about the same. Venus is quite different. Venus is also very, 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 very hot. There's a rationalization for it that it has, you know, carbon dioxide effect, but it's far beyond anything anybody can model with a little bit of carbon dioxide or even a lot of carbon dioxide. In fact, it's got plasma lightning shooting up and down from the upper atmosphere, and there are no water clouds, and that should bury the idea of lightning being made in water clouds. I did a video on that previously. So the lightning on Venus is something that's happening as a result of its strong electromagnetic charge, perhaps having been ejected from a star. Now you have to say, but why would something be ejected from a star? Now we look at our major star, the Sun. It's ejecting stuff all the time. Look at a brown dwarf and imagine that it is electrically unstable. And this is all Wall Thornhill's stuff, coming through Ralph Jurgens and Hannes Alfvén and Ralph Sansbury and others, whom Wall has internalized and sort of formed his own conceptualizations about, which I think are fascinating, often seem very testable. In fact, they're doing tests of an electric sun over there at the Sapphire Project. I recommend that you look that up at thunderbolts.info. So if a brown dwarf star is electrically unstable and it has a current coming in, it can do a number of things to adapt to its electrically unstable environment. It can expand like a sail, expanding and capturing more of the electromagnetic current to, if it's a very weak current, it will expand to try to capture more. If it's a very strong current, it will contract and glow brighter. Has this ever happened? Absolutely. Astronomers have seen stars contract, glow brighter, brighter still, and they see a supernova explosion, and then they see two stars. They actually see a star, they don't want to admit what happened, but a star split into two because the electromagnetic energy coming into it was too strong for one to bear. So it splits, it increases its surface area, and is able to now handle the local electromagnetic current in the area. Have they seen stars get bigger? Yes, they have. Bigger and duller, because the larger they get, the weaker the plasma gets. Now, the plasma glow around something like a brown dwarf star is very low, very weak. I mentioned, and you can look this up online, there are stars that have been discovered that are not much more than 100 degrees. You could definitely fly a little planetoid through that with a little electromagnetic bubble around it and have life absolutely burst there on in every quarter, in every quadrant, there would be no differentiation between the temperature at the poles and the temperature at the equator. Well, what do you find when you look at Earth and you look at the ancient, fossil record of Earth? Well, you see giant ferns and giant trees in Antarctica, in the Arctic. You see tropical plants everywhere on the planet with no differentiation, as though the whole planet were bathed in the same kind of electromagnetic plasma warmth, warm glow of a brown dwarf or red dwarf star. Sounding a little less crazy. But of course, Carl Sagan mocked a man named Emanuel Velikovsky and Carl Sagan's long, boring series called Cosmos, which was almost entirely fiction, which I watched and read the book dutifully when I was a kid, complete with its Big Bang fiction and its Last Perfect Day on Earth fiction, all of their retelling of biblical Genesis, all of their recapitulation of old Babylonian, Assyrian, Egyptian myths, gussied up with a little bit of fake math. Yes, that's NASA astronomy, which is why there's a flat Earth movement, because NASA does lie all the time. They just don't lie about the Earth being flat. Just try to get it a little more right. Okay. So Carl Sagan ridiculed Emanuel Velikovsky, who said that the planets had passed by each other and had caused each other great harm. That Venus was the was Inanna and Ishtar of the sky. That Venus and Aphrodite had a fearsome Kali-like aspect, the thing that Dave Talbot talks about all the time in his work. And Velikovsky said that there's a reason that he predicted that Venus would be intensely hot. Unreasonably so. He predicted there would be radio signals, electromagnetic signals coming out of Saturn and Jupiter, I believe, one of the two. He predicted all of these things. He was right, and nobody wants to credit him. But now, Carl Sagan, by the way, said it's impossible for a planet. Imagine Mars. You can look up the video. Imagine Mars going like this. Well, given the little that we know and understand, he should have said, about gravity, it would be impossible for planets to go out and then pass each other. They would just hit each other or not hit each other. What he didn't understand, and what Velikovsky didn't understand, what Wal Thornhill does understand, is that it's an electromagnetic universe, and electromagnetic capture is a much strong increases the probability of being pulled into a much larger star hundredsfold. It's no longer a probability game of Newtonian mechanics. You're being pulled in by an electromagnetic attractor. You're pulled in and then you're repelled at a certain point because the electromagnetic attraction force is also a repulsion force at a certain point. Planets passing each other won't bump into each other. They'll discharge electromagnetically. Each has an electromagnetic bubble sphere around them, and all that has to do is the bubble spheres have to hit for the planets to be ripped apart, not totally, but the surface. So you look at the Valles Marineris on Mars, 5 miles deep, no river, no body of water, no flowing water, carving all the channels at once or over time and then disappearing to nowhere, no alluvial plain, no dispensation of material from a once existing river. Does it sound like a river carved a 5 mile deep canyon that, you know, looks like a great Lichtenberg lightning figure, like a great fractal figure? Does it? It doesn't to people who try to reason with it, who try to be rational about it. If you're stuck on an old story, you can make up anything you want. I suppose you can put a black hole there on Mars to suck away the atmosphere and dig the Valles Marineris. On the other hand, here on planet Earth, we have something very similar called the Grand Canyon, which researchers understand could not have been carved by a body of water going uphill and then somehow burrowing through the densest rock that could be found instead of doing what water would do, which was just, you know, come over and not burrow through it, go through the weaker rock, go through the path of least resistance. Water doesn't flow uphill and it doesn't carve something like the Grand Canyon that has all of these tendrils coming in from the side. Lightning scars look like the Grand Canyon. This has been pointed out by Wal Thornhill, Stephen Smith, another fine researcher at thunderbolts.info. We don't live in a universe that looks anything like the one that's described to us by NASA. And I think that that does fuel the flat Earth insaniacs, you know, in their suppositions about a Sheol and all that kind of bullshit. But it really is an electromagnetic universe. And it's fascinating to look into it. I wrote chapter 9 of my book, chapters 8 on Darwinism, chapters 10 on plate tectonics, and chapters 11, again, about a more electromagnetic version of evolution, are all about it. So 8, 9, 10, and 11 of my book, Official Stories, will clue you into some of the problems with these greater sciences. The biological sciences are covered in chapters 5 and 6. You can support this message of independent journalism by putting a couple dollars into the PayPal. My name is Liam Sheff. This is American Heretic. My book, again, is Official Stories. Don't be afraid to jump into the electric universe. It's very, very fun stuff. Issues that we don't talk about, they're never on the news, but they are the most significant for our health and well-being, and I'm going to talk about those a little bit. My name is Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories, The Truth About Love. My video movies are Surviving Sea-Doo and The Oil Alarm. This is American Heretic, sponsored and funded by you. Put a couple dollars into the PayPal. Thank you. Well, we look around the country, we worry about jobs, we worry about the economy. The economy is code word. Code word for what? Code word for the petroleum state. If there is a lot of oil, we have an economy, we can make the machines work. A barrel of oil is what we use every day. We use 19 or so million with an M, barrels of oil every day. 19 million. What do you use 19 million of? Using 19 million barrels of oil per day in the country gives us all about 150 to 200 energy slaves. People keeping us cool, making us warm, cooking our food, picking our food, planting our food, giving us our products, our textiles, our petroleum products, dragging everything to us so we don't have to go very far, powering the giant water buffalo that we ride in, the giant metal rhinoceros, like lemmings in tiny metal boxes, shiny metal boxes, driving around all the time to get something because we forgot it, and the cake that we're making really just needs that little dash of artificial lemon-flavored something or other from the Walmart, and it's still open because it's 24-hour America. Oil is what we use 19 million barrels of a day so that we all have about 200, 150 energy slaves. If oil went down by half, we wouldn't have 75 energy slaves, we would have none, because to run an economy like this, the one that we live in, the one that is 24-hour delivery, constant, 365 day a year. Can we deliver on Sunday, please? Says Amazon.com. Yes, you can, because I want it now. Can we have two-day delivery? Yes, if you pay $100 a year, you can. Everything available whenever we want it because we have oil. In order to keep that running, we can't have 50% of the oil we have. If we had 50% of the oil we have, we'd all have to grow food locally. We'd have a few things that came in from far away on trains. We'd be living like it was the very early 1900s, or more likely the 1800s, if we had half of the oil. If we used half the oil per day, that would be about 9 or so million barrels of oil per day. We would all live locally, grow food locally, but we don't. We live as though we could afford to have 20 million barrels of oil per day. That is about 6 billion barrels of oil per year, all in one country. We use 20 million in this country alone. We use about 90 million per day in the world. That means that we use 2 out of 9, which is a significant percentage, somewhere over 20% of the oil used by 4% of the people. Americans, as you know, had it good, and we don't want to give it up, so we'll go to war with anybody under any false pretenses that we can, including blowing up buildings, so we can go into the Middle East where it happens to be a lot of oil. Also, some people whose parents we kill with radioactive material who then say that they hate us. Big surprise. We don't want to give up the American way of life. We use 19 million barrels of oil a day. One barrel of oil is worth 5.8 million British thermal units. A British thermal unit, a single one, is the amount of heat it takes to take 1 pound of water and increase it 1 degree. So, a barrel of oil worth 5.8 million British thermal units is enough to take one pound of water and increase it to 5.8 million degrees, which doesn't exist anymore, or to take 5.8 million pounds of water and increase it a degree, or somewhere along that continuum. It is, in other words, a fucking shit buttload of work. A lot of work. More work than you can imagine doing in a lifetime. In fact, it is more work than you can imagine doing in a lifetime. Because it is essentially 10 to 15,000 hours of human labor, which if you divide by, let's see, 3 to get 8 hour, 24, 365, you end up with 2 times 5 8-hour days, you end up with about 5 to 7 years of a day job. So 10 to 15,000 hours of human labor per barrel of oil is the equivalent of about 5
5 to 7 years of a day job, whatever, somewhere around that range, 8 hour day, 5 days a week. Okay, now take that and multiply it by 19 or 20 to make it easier. Let's call it 5 years at the low end. 5 years of a day job times 20 million is, that's right, 100 million years of labor at a day job. Every year in the United States, all of the UPS, FedEx, and every other kind of truck that runs around ends up doing about 100 million years of work. That's 5 years of work times 20 million barrels. That's barrel years. We're doing about 100 million barrel years of work in the Roman Empire, in the Greek city-states, in the Babylonian and Assyrian empires. Under Alexander, under the long marches, on our feet, we're doing 100 million years of work making airplanes go through the sky. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds per day. There are no amount of Egyptian slaves or any other kind of people doing any kind of work that could ever put something through the air at 600 miles per hour so that we can get our new Blu-ray set of The Force Awakens just in time at the Target because we want it in 24 hours, not 72, or in 5 days. Yes, we're used to having things at an unreasonable rate of speed. We're also used to getting food from an unreasonable distance, like from China or anywhere in South America, coming up to Detroit or Boston or Los Angeles or somewhere very, very inland, not on a waterway that, like Las Vegas, which shouldn't exist at all, but does exist thanks to that 19 million barrels of work per day, representing about 100 million years of labor. There are 100 million years of labor going on keeping your house cool, keeping it warm, keeping it cool in one room and warm in another, making your sleep adjustment bed go up so your girlfriend who snores a little is a little bit higher than you who are a little bit lower, because God forbid you should sleep on something that was made of local fabrics like hemp and sewn into a futon. God forbid you'd be some sort of horrible hippie communist supporting local economies and doing work that existed within a framework of locally abundant and available. You don't want to be one of those people. You might end up voting for Bernie instead of Hillary, and then you'd have to kill yourself. You're going to vote for Trump just to be, well, an outlier. And you've been reading Ayn Rand lately, who says that you could do anything in the world as long as you treat people badly enough and, she didn't say, have enough oil. Oil is the thing that makes this world happen. If we don't have it, we don't get to do 100 million years of day labor per day. We're stuck living where we live, producing food where we live, getting some things at a sustainable level, reasonably sustainable, using oil and coal to push trains along the, well, along the train tracks. Now, I hear the objection from the daydream believers in the audience about free energy. I'd like to just take this moment to thank Nikola Tesla for inventing the dynamo. He wasn't alone in doing it. He simply took the Faraday motor and unhinged it, the Faraday motor which spun and scraped a metallic charger and generated an electroforce by scraping a magnet, was released from the scraping, the electromagnets were put on the outside, and the wheel was made to spin very freely and fast. That's Nikola Tesla's great invention and his gift to the world. That's it. We use Tesla energy every day. So when people say maybe Tesla energy will save us, I think, like what? Like the energy we use every day generated on dynamos and then put into AC alternating current engines? Well, he did that. And he wasn't alone. He didn't invent it by himself. He came along with a lot of other people, electrical engineers who were there in the zeitgeist, like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were in a zeitgeist of using silica pathways to generate binary code processing machines that we now call computers and we all are used to having all the time. So Tesla came about after Faraday and Maxwell and a few Ohm and Volta and others and came up with a machine that could generate electricity. Now, maybe there's electricity in the air, but not very bloody much, or we'd be all electrocuted all the fucking time. It doesn't take a motherfucking rocket scientist to realize that you're not going to come up with a free energy source that isn't there through the available energy that hits us, which isn't a lot, or we'd be electrocuted all the time. So, those of you who write me about suppressed free energy and then post another stupid fucking YouTube video, sorry, but I get them too often, sorry, about the hydrogen-powered car, about the water-powered car that is really a dihydrogen-powered car, a car that takes, whose engine splits water with a strong electrical zap and then burns the hydrogen, that's not running on water, it's running on hydrogen. You had to store the electricity in a very, very large, powerful battery to zap the water. Sorry for my outburst, but do you get it? There's no free energy out there that anybody's invented. As close as somebody got was somebody who took a carbon nanofiber tube and got it to vibrate and oscillate at something approximating the level of sunlight and was therefore able to capture some electricity from it. That's impressive. But you know how bloody hard it is to build that kind of shit? Do you know how expensive it is? So, a word on Nikola Tesla. We use Tesla energy every day. If you have something that you think has been suppressed, I'm sure there are not free energy, but energy efficiency machines that are not being used because the economy will not bear it or it's not required in a world in which we are burning 19 million barrels. Think about that number now, 19 million barrels a day, which are now on the decline worldwide. Now, Saudi Arabian oil fields have been pumped with seawater since 1965 as Venezuela goes into hawk for its tarry oil, not a sweet, light crude that's easy to get, but a very tarry oil that's very hard to get. There is a difference. There are differences among and between the varieties of oil, but this is lost on the average Joe Schmo doing internet mythic work on the conspiracy myth work, saying that they're suppressing it all and we can do everything we want. Back to real thermodynamics. We're running lower on the stuff that makes the 100 slaves, the 200 slaves per day work for us. And because we're so opposed to talking about doing things locally and growing food locally, we're all going to end up in a real giant stinking pot of cannibalistic hot water very, very soon if we don't start paying attention to relocalizing. If you're holding out hope that the free energy machine of the future gets made, I guess I'll throw in 2 cents into the hope bin with you. I'm not opposed to a little bit of hope, but I think more comes from common sense and hard work. After all, said the number of people who wrote the various books that were eventually collected by the total frauds in Rome called the Bible, the Lord helps those who help themselves. So maybe we should be working a little bit harder on a local level to procure those things we need so that when Monsanto land goes into hiccup and collapse, we don't all have to join the government work camps to keep Monsanto land going. Rather, that's work camp, volunteer to keep Monsanto land going. Let's pull that away. Instead, let's rehabilitate the soil where we live. And if you can't, think about going where it's wet and rainy. And think about permaculture, think about aquaponics, and think about a future that goes beyond the next year. Think about a future that extends 5 years and 10 in a world in which we'll have 75% of the oil or 50% of the oil that we now use. Now, if a free energy source comes along, I guarantee it will be very much owned and operated by a very small group of people. It will be very difficult to know what's happening. And by the way, look what we've done with 150 years or 100 years, a century of free energy called oil. We've absolutely annihilated the planet, built nuclear energy, which is murdering oceans and murdering people all over the world. We've exploded 2,050 nuclear bombs in the upper or lower atmosphere, underwater, in near space and underground. We've totally irradiated ourselves. We've genetically modified our food for no good reason. We're spraying it with poison, which is the real reason for genetically modifying the food, so that we can sell more glyphosate to everybody, tell them that GMO food is not necessarily harmful. But yeah, the glyphosate fucking is. Hey, everybody, a little bit of logic applied doesn't add up to big bucks for Monsanto. Okay, you get the idea. 100 million slave years of work per day. That's what we cannot replace. There's no way to replace it. Elon Musk's stuff is going out of business all over the place. He's just a giant Ponzi scheme waiting for somebody to call him on his bluff. All of the stuff that he envisions is totally reliant on cheap oil to get there. Now, energy efficiency, that's the way of the future. So the next time somebody comes along and talks free energy to you, just post this video and say, look, give me the blueprint and show me where it's happening. Otherwise, energy efficiency is the word of the day. If you can become very energy efficient and food local to the 70% degree, you can survive the coming die down, Holocaust, the pain that we are all going to face as we don't have what made Don Draper want to work on Madison Avenue. We're not going to have enough oil to make the plastic that we're now used to imbibing every day. And we're going to have to live something that resembles a local life. My movie on this is called The Oil Alarm. It's going to be out in its full version in October. It's available in partial, in clips, in good clips, good chunky clips on YouTube. My books are Official Stories, which does talk a little about the oil state and 9/11, the reason that we had to go into the Middle East. And it does talk about the electric universe. I might mention Tesla here or there. Mostly, though, it's about what's wrong with the sciences, the arts, like Shakespeare, like English, and the biological sciences, too, also with American history. My other book is The Truth About Love, which asks questions about the nature of our species in a whimsical way. It's not nearly so heavy. This is American Heretic. Please support this message of independent research. Time spent pulling the details out of a a hundred other sites, and bringing them to you in a distilled form so that you can take away a more clear message about what is probably coming, which is not a great NIH CDC promised Holocaust of a Zika virus, but is rather a low energy society in which a lot of people can starve very quickly because we haven't heeded the warning of outliers saying it's time to grow food again. Some people think we're monogamous, but nobody acts like they are. And I'd like to talk about that problem. We are a human mammal. I'd like to talk about what that means. And to get to the bottom layer of what our actual sexual identity is, I think I want to talk about the human species as an animal species. My name is Liam Schaff. My books are Official Stories and The Truth About Love. This is American Heretic, sponsored and funded by you. Please put a couple dollars into the PayPal if you learn something new or stumble upon an interesting idea, or get an answer to something you've been wondering about for a long time. I've been told all of those can happen watching these videos. So, what are we? We're a mammal. We live on planet Earth. There's no reason to assume we're the only planet with life on it. In fact, it's only reasonable to assume that every wet, rocky planet in the anode glow of a star spirals out life according to an infinite pattern that uses all of the materials at hand to recreate reflective, sentient, hungry, thirsty, observant life everywhere that it can, and that those patterns are welded into the electromagnetic nature of the universe. You can dispense with Darwinism, which says life came about accidentally. Darwinism doesn't have any idea why life came about or even why it changes. It simply recognizes that life seems well attuned to particular environments, which might actually speak more for life's ability to tune into environments or to form from environments than it does for accidents to happen that are somehow beneficial to an environment in which the accident happened. No, Darwinism gets it backwards, and I talk about that in Chapter 8 of my book. We don't have any reason to think of ourselves so narcissistically as being the only form of life in the universe. The universe itself must be considered alive, and we are nothing but the sense organs of the universe, curious about itself, looking at itself, manifesting in such a way over and over again, eyes, nasal smell, touch, tactile, all the other things that inhabit us, in new forms, and new forms, and new forms, infinite variety, subtle shifts over every animal species. Okay, there's no way to figure out how exactly life metamorphoses from one to the other, except the plastic state inside the uterus is the best guess for when things really, really change. And that would have to be driven by an environment. So if you're a pregnant female and the environment shifts, if it doesn't kill you, your newborn may look very, very different because it has more quickly and readily adapted to the influx of new materials from the environment. There may be subtler electromagnetic shifts that occur. We don't know. Nobody's investigating that. They're all after Darwinism, which again is neither testable nor real. Life doesn't come about by accident, and life doesn't change by accident, and it doesn't perfectly accommodate itself to new environments by accident. The environment and the organism are in a dance, they alter each other, so on and so forth, to the end of time of which there is none. All right, so what is a mammal? A mammal is an animal that has unrolled to a particular point where it's experimented with having hair on its body, losing some here, gaining some here, and we are a mammal that vocalizes. Mammals breastfeed, they give live birth. We then are at play in the field of the experience of the universal thread of consciousness, which wants to imbue life with consciousness, and which plays at imbuing life with consciousness. We, therefore, are imbued with consciousness because the universe is conscious and wants to have that experience of self-consciousness. So, we go through the world and we realize that we are. Human beings realize that we are, and we think ourselves very special. So goes the Hindu or the ancient story, maybe from the Upanishads, about the origin of the universe coming into being and being afraid because it realizes that it is. And then it realizes it's alone and that it's no longer afraid, but it's bored, so it pretends to be everything else. Great metaphor for how things probably are. Mammals are very sexual. Let's put that nail right down there on the board. Mammals are very, very sexual. We think about sex a lot. We're very playful. We're imitative. We like to make different sounds of all the things around us. We're creative. If we see something, we like to draw it and paint it and create a tableau for it. all of the things that exist, from the moon to the sun to the sky to the river to the lake to the stream to the crows to all the other animals that exist, we create as little gods, little personalities in our mind. We're animistic by nature. Christianity has a very hard time squashing this. Disney is the animist soul of Christianity, and Christianity is so non-monotheistic, it's worth its own episode. Why Christianity is not really monotheistic, we'll get to it. Mammals, then, are a very sexual, playful, imitative, and social creature. In some ways, we sometimes wish to be alone. We wish to be alone with our thoughts, which we can't really get to when we have to compromise with all the people around us. And so we sometimes seek isolation, but then we get lonely, and we seek the comfort and pleasure and touch, smell and taste, really, of the people around us. The taste of shared food, and sometimes of, well, I don't mean this in a cannibalistic way, but of the sensual pleasures of love. Which is where I started. Now, are we monotheistic? Sorry, are we monogamous or, what was the word, polyamorous? Some people would say that not only are we monotheistic, but we're monogamous. In fact, we come through a period of life in which we are turned on by just about everything and everyone. We're Twitter-pated, as the movie Bambi tells us, and we fall in love very easily. Of course, we're going to get our hearts broken because the first love can't be your true love. What fun would there be in that? Which doesn't really make sense, because if you're monogamous, you really should only be after one egg in your whole life, and it should be the opposite, and you should have your soulmate and read all the Richard Bach books until the point where he actually got divorced and was called a bunch of names. So we're monogamous, but we have to date and get our hearts broken and break some hearts and flirt and have a lot of fun and learn about sex, and then finally we meet the one with whom we are with sort of for the rest of our lives, except for all the exceptions. Now, if I'm somebody who's interested in how people really live, not how they say they live, I look upon the culture and I see all the churches where people go to repent the fact that they're not as they're told they should be. This is the first clue that we're not really a monogamous species, but we're rather a sexual species that thinks about sex a lot, very naturally, as the kind of mammal that we are. We wouldn't accuse dogs of being a bunch of cunty, slutty whores for not being a very monogamous species. They're just dogs. It wouldn't occur to us to call all cats horrifying sluts and slatterns and tramps and trollops and whores, because they're not incredibly monogamous. We just accuse them of being cats. But when it comes to people, we call ourselves tramps and trollops and sluts and slatterns and whores. And worse, we call ourselves all kinds of things and then go to the divorce lawyers to collect all the money as we cry, and they sympathize with their fake crocodile tears as they steal all of our money from us for not being able to keep up a deal that we never made. Actually, we never really thought to make it. Are we truly monotheistic sexually? Do we really only worship one pair of boobies or one wang our whole lives? Do we really? Not really. We're just a sexual species. We get turned on by people in our group, people of similar experience, people who turn on our ideas, people with really killer bodies, to use the internet term for it. Pamela Anderson, did I mention her? Brigitte Bardot. If God was a man and people are created in his image, then God must look like Brigitte Bardot, right? Or I guess David Hasselhoff, if that's your thing, but really, Brigitte Bardot. So, are we monogamous or are we polygamous? Well, all cultures on Earth have not been monotheistic. In fact, there is no monogamous. All cultures on Earth are not monogamous. Now, some, like ours, like the Judeo-Christian culture or the Islamic culture, give a lot of lip service to being monogamous. But they all have exceptions. Like, men can do whatever they want. They have massage parlors, happy endings, a lot of media that shows a lot of boobies and vagina and penises going into vaginas. You can just go on the internet all the time and you'll find no shortage of people seeming not to be very monogamous in a monogamous culture. And you may, as a social scientist, say, proposition, we are a monogamous culture. Contrary evidence, everything. Okay, so you go to the church and you feel bad about not following the rules that they give you, that they've broken for 2,000 years, or 1,700 years, or however long you grant the church for existing, 1,600 years, depending. And even after it was created, there was no idea of monogamy within the church, or what's the other word? Where they've refused to use their genitals except on anything except children. Ah, yes, Catholics. Always telling us how to feel and how to live, and covering it up until they make a movie that gets a couple Academy Awards a couple hundred years after all the terrible things are over and nobody gives a fuck anymore. Yes, it's religion, our best friend. So there are reasons to doubt that religion is our best friend. We adults aren't allowed to go out into the world and proclaim ourselves asexual species who enjoys the company of other people in our peer group who excite us, who excite our minds, who excite our hearts, and who excite our bodies. But the church is there to tell us how to live and what to feel bad about and where to put all the coins when we do what they've always told us not to do, when they've been doing far worse. The social scientist begs the question, this doesn't seem very accurate. Now, beyond the church, we have the state. The state tells us also that we're allowed to have sex and get married. The state tells us we can have as much sex as we want, really, as long as we put latex on ourselves, sort of. Or at least you say that it's a good idea for gay people to do, but you do what you want in the college dorms. Just, you know, that's your business, until you get married, at which point it becomes the state's business. Now, after you get married, according to the state, you can do whatever you want, but you have to pay them when it all goes to shit. So, if you have to pay them when it goes to shit, and they actually have an entire institutional court system which collects from you as it goes to shit, you might say that they're not really enforcing monogamy as much as they're forcing the penalty on the impossibility of monogamy, or the impossibility of, you know, restraining your desires to only one person forever and ever, till suicide, death do you part, alone with your genitals shriveled up watching Jeopardy and guessing at the answers, which you all know because you've been watching Jeopardy for so long, because Lord knows you don't fuck anymore, and you don't talk about sex because that would be wrong, says the people in the church, and you don't have sex with anybody else because you don't want to have to go to the divorce lawyers just because you had a little episode of kissy huggy something or other with somebody who really liked you and you liked, which enriched your life, but don't do it because you have the two polar camps waiting to collect crocodile tears and a lot of money from you. Are we a monogamous species? You can try to be monogamous, but your mind will betray you all the time. When Pamela Anderson or Brigitte Bardot or David Hasselhoff walk down the street and you in one way or another go swing for whatever turns you on, you've broken your vow of mental chastity. You can't control that. You can wear a hair shirt and be like a John the Baptist fellow and just make your life acrimonious to itself. You can hate yourself as much as possible for having a sex drive, or you can do what most Americans do, which is become befuddled hypocrites. You can just become a befuddled hypocrite, clucking your tongue at People magazine, or, you know, watching a lot of HBO and Netflix and Showtime, which is just, you know, just fucking on television. What was Californication? Honestly, really? Culturally enriching? Maybe a little, not really. It was the truth about the way some people live and about the way a lot of people kind of in their fantasies wish they could live. Of course, when you liberate yourself to admit that you're a sexual person, you definitely don't want to go around fucking everybody, because fucking is special. Fucking is what you reserve for somebody or the few somebodies in life who you end up really caring about and you want to have that deeper connection with. Fucking isn't something that you throw away at the bar. Making out, you can throw away at the bar. A blowjob, maybe you could go give away at the bar, maybe. I would do an inspection first, make sure there are no special bumps or scuff marks that don't go away. A little oral sex here and there is maybe something that you can give away at the bar or with a not intensely personal friend, but that's up to you. That's really up to you. What I'm saying, though, is that we should have a... I know, I lost a lot of you with that last bit, but tell the truth. Fucking is a little bit special. It should be a little bit special. Penetrative sex should be a little bit special. And maybe the church should just say, penetrative sex should be a little bit special, not in the least because you can have a kid, and then you're really in hock for a long time. And maybe the court should say, you don't have to get a divorce just because you find somebody else attractive, and if you make out with somebody, you probably go home hornier and, you know, want to fuck better as a result of having your hormones turned back on, because they, Lord knows, they've been turned off for years because you've shut them off at home. You've shut them off on the outside, so they automatically get shut off at home, which is a terrible problem of trying to behave as though you only have sexual interest in one person who you've sort of lost interest in because he's gained 60 pounds, and it's not his fault. He is stressed, and he does have that thyroid condition now as a result of bowling too much and eating a lot of hamburgers. Nevertheless, you're going to try to put in your wifely/husbandly duty and just give it a go around once in a while, and no wonder your sex drive isn't very high. But maybe it would be higher, but you shut it down on the outside because you feel so ashamed if you manage to show any slight indication to the partner who you're with, who you're maybe still into, but you sort of forgot because you have so many bills to pay and so many plans on the boiler that you all have to accomplish before the next bill cycle comes along, before the kids end up in college. You got so much to do so often. How do you have time to think about each other sexually anymore? Well, the answer is probably to flirt more. Probably. At least researchers have found that people who flirt more, have a kiss and a cuddle here and there, are much more turned on at home and have better sex lives. Of course, you'd have to get out of your mind that you're going to go to the state to get them to rip apart your possessions and give half to so-and-so and half to the lawyers, light the other half on fire and cry about the wounds, or go to the church and actually ask the pedophile priests and popes who've made it okay to abuse and hate and murder and create pogroms and civil wars and strifes and crusades against each other for a couple thousand years. Instead of going to them for permission to be a person, maybe it's time to get a little more modern and try to read a little bit about human psychology or anthropology or, you know, anything like that that ends with an ology and doesn't begin with "give us all your money." These are ideas, these are thoughts on the question of monogamy versus, I don't know, a more human-level sexuality. My name is Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories and The Truth About Love. If you enjoyed this message, please put a couple dollars into the PayPal. Really, if this stimulates your life or your mind, put a couple dollars in with my thanks. See you then. I mean, then being next time. Also then. Also next time. Where's the stop button? It's time for all of us to stop thinking that we're all going to have our own home. I think that we should welcome the death of the single family home in America and get back to a more relatively collective and sane way of thinking. Not totally collective, not communist, but relatively collective and more sane. My name's Liam Sheff. My books are Official Stories, The Truth About Love. My movies are The Oil Alarm, Surviving Sea-Doo. This is American Heretic, funded by you. Please find the PayPal links if you learned something. Forever and ever and ever and ever, in towns and villages and hamlets across Europe, Asia, Africa, South America, North America, Canadian America, Australia America, every other America that exists, people lived in groups. People didn't live in single-family homes. They didn't have cars, shiny metal boxes that they pulled up in the driveway at the end of the day so they could just binge on House of Cards on Netflix because they're so depressed and tired from their job all day long. People lived in groups. You didn't have a refrigerator in your house. You had a hut or a house that you shared with other people. You had a kitchen or an outdoor cooking place that you shared with everybody. This, to an American, is some kind of communist heresy. What do you mean I don't have my own marble-topped, radar range, newly installed shiny brushed aluminum or whatever the style and fashion is this second of the day stove that I would use myself once in a while when I wasn't buying dinner out, when I was driving home from the job that I'm not that fond of, but it's very important to work harder because I might get a raise, even though I never get to see the kids again, and they are acting funny since I took them to the doctor, actually. I'm a little worried about that, but I don't want to be anti-science. So, better pick up dinner, not at Chipotle, because they had that health scare. Better to go to Subway, Burger King, Arby's, anything other than Chipotle. Don't go to Chipotle. They had a health scare, don't you know? McDonald's has never had a health scare. They don't have tumors in their meat either, or an allowable level of pus and blood in their milk. Well, they do, but don't worry about that. We never had this kind of life where we were isolated, where we lived alone, cooked alone, had a larder or a kitchen stockroom that was just ours. We shared. Now, what's the value of sharing? The value of sharing is that stuff sits in our larder, our cabinets, for months and months and months. When there are groups of people, somebody's going to use it. That means that you're going to rotate it faster, you're going to have a need to procure more locally, you're not going to have to buy it at store, you're going to procure more locally, have it there, somebody's going to make something, and you're not even going to have to cook it. You're going to make one thing, and somebody else is going to make another. What an idea, you're going to share food together. It's almost as though we enjoy eating together. I don't know if you, like me, have ever traveled or gone to youth hostels around the world or travelers' hotels. I cook in everyone that I go to. I cook meals for people. Whenever I visit people, I cook meals for them if they enjoy slightly Indian, Ethiopian, healthy, vegetarian-ish food. Vegetarian-ish food. I can cook fish. I don't really like to cook anything other than fish, though, I'll be honest. Just don't enjoy it. But I will cook you a very nice meal if I'm there. And it seems to me that when people eat together, they eat more slowly. They enjoy conversation. They look at each other. They don't look at a television. If they remember to put down their phones, they even have a better time. It seems, though, that there's some sort of inborn, you could almost call it
if you're going to be scientastic about it, genetic predisposition to enjoying eating together, which would go against, of course, everything we've been taught about it, the horrible communists and how they are forced to do things together. Because we know that we would rather sit in front of Netflix and watch House of Cards and just binge on House of Cards while we're stuffing food into our mouth so that we don't really know if we're hungry or when we're full, so that we actually eat twice as much as we really should if we were actually chewing the food. And besides the fact that it was microwaved and everything that was useful in it as a nutrient has been warped and altered, and many of them made into carcinogens, actually, which is interesting if you think about it. Microwaves which cook in a way that food has never been cooked by the polar molecule of water being spun hundreds or thousands of times a minute or even a second seems to be a strange new thing to do to our bodies, but we know that's what we really want because we're Americans and it would be terrible to eat together. Or it might be great to get out of the habit of eating in our cars and driving through things, and instead live in non-single family houses where we shared kitchens. Now you can have your own bedroom, and the kids can have their own bedroom, and the adults can have their own bedrooms, and you could even have bedrooms arranged in different sides of a larger house. But you could have a big shared kitchen. You'd share the water bill. You'd share the heating bill. You'd share the utility bill. So the amount of energy that you had to spend in bringing you the water would be a little less. You might learn to conserve a little bit of water because you're sharing with more people. And instead of taking that 20-minute shower because you just had one of those days, you might take a 5 or 8-minute shower. In fact, you might put in, because there's more of you living in a place, you might put in, oh, a better heating system that didn't heat 80 gallons of water at once, which just gets wasted, but was rather a heating system which only heated the water that you were using at the moment. It might be interesting to do that. And if you were living in a multiple family house, you might have the money to install that windmill and solar system that you've been dying to do, but you just couldn't. You could afford half of it, but not all of it. But now there are twice as many of you, so you can actually afford it. Wow. Suddenly you find your electric bill is 40% of what it was. Maybe you can afford to have a slightly longer shower. Oh, but that's running on gas. So anyway, maybe you'll put in a solar kit on top that isn't even electrical, that just heats the water with black glass or plastic, something that was done all over the South before cheap electrical energy was put in all over the South, running on, well, coal, gas, and nuclear, so that we all have to heat the water in the deep South and through the Southwest instead of just letting the sun, which is burning us all up all the time, to heat the water. Things that you could achieve if you didn't have to foot all the bills yourself. You'd have more food, you'd have more prepared food at home because there'd be more people at home who needed to eat. You'd have more people learning to become cooks. Now let's think about a system in which people would get sick. Guess what you'd have? More stay-home nurses. There'd be more people, more teens, more kids, more young people, and even more adults going, well, actually, I know a remedy for that. I know a remedy for that. I can help take care of that. So what are we afraid of? It sounds like a win-win. Well, we get annoyed with each other. We do. We all want to be alone because people are annoying. So you live with one person who you share a room with, but really you actually have an extra bedroom because you both got on each other's nerves, and you have a den so that he can go down there and just do whatever he does on the internet. You're not asking any questions, but you really do need a workout room because you're just going crazy and the kids are always in your room. So you have an extra workout room, which does make, I think, four bedrooms for the two of you now. And you know it would be a terrible inconvenience just to have one big rec room where people got to play things together and blow off steam and have fun. What a terrible, terrible nightmare that would be to have more than a single family house where you didn't have to pay all of the bills yourself, where you got to split them with people, where people were making more money one month or less money one month, but it always seemed to balance out a little better, where people brought in more food. You had more people to care for each other when you were sick or even in a bad mood, more people to talk to so that you didn't just bunch up in that tiny two-person single-point meditation that drives you crazy because you can't just get all of your reflections done by one person who's having a bad day and can't really have the room to hear you. So isn't it great that you have some other people around just to talk to? Oh, but what about time alone? We all need time alone, and you're going to have to arrange for a little time-out space for yourself. There is a place available to most people, though, who buy a house. It is a place that we've sort of shut down and we don't really go to anymore. It's a place called Outside. There's a place called Outside that you can go to and, what's the word, walk. You can go walk outside and have time to yourself. So if you learn to walk outside or bike or roll or any of the other things that you can do when you go outside, you can actually have that time to yourself in there's a place that's related to outside. It's called nature, something like that. So you can go outside and walk and be connected to nature and have that time to yourself. And I know that's a task and a bore when you'd rather be in your car driving and competing with people on the road for a little bit of space so that you can get to the store, which you think is open late enough, but you're not sure. One of the other things you can do with more people being around on a multifamily house, though, is you're going to have a little more yard space. So instead of just using that for something really useful like a trampoline, which God knows everybody needs an extra trampoline, you couldn't just share one in some kind of community recreation center that you put together in all of your multifamily houses so you didn't all have to buy a swimming pool and a trampoline for your house, but you could share in a neighborhood. But you don't want kids to play with each other. God knows you don't want them to learn to cooperate, learn each other's names, recognize each other's faces, learn compassion and empathy by having normal childhood experiences. Much better to keep them inside in your single family house, terrified of the neighbors, playing video games, which really are the way that we should be socially conditioning ourselves. On the other hand, in a neighborhood, you could do all of these things together. Sure, there'll be some hurt feelings, some scraped knees. You may have to actually talk with each other. You may actually have to be involved in each other's lives a little, and I know that it's a burden. But there is that nature thing outside where you can walk or bike or roll, depending on what you can do and what you enjoy doing. And that's a good way to blow off steam, isn't it? The other thing that you can do, though, in your backyard, because you don't have to have the trampoline swimming pool combination anymore, is you can do something called a gardening. So you can do this gardening thing, and that makes something called food. Yeah, like food like you eat. It's supposed to come from the store or the Arby's or the Hardee's. You definitely don't want to eat at Chipotle. Don't go there. They had a food scare. So you can do all of this stuff in multifamily homes, in multifamily home neighborhoods. I know. It's probably a little communist-y, though, and the homeowners associations might get afraid that you're talking with each other too much and actually developing interpersonal relationships that have meaning and value that sustain you over the course of your life. What's the state going to do? How is the church going to thrive in a multifamily environment where you're not feeling ashamed of yourself for having friends all the time? I don't understand it. I know. I know what I'm saying is definitely wrong for most people. On the other hand, we're all getting more poor. We are not land rich. Our resources are dwindling. Our oil supply is lower. Our coal supply is lower. Maybe it might be a good idea to stop thinking so, selfishly, as we've been programmed to by Don Draper in the Men of Madison Avenue, who had an unlimited amount of oil to burn, and imagine what it might be like to construct willfully, intentionally, that's an interesting word, intentionally, a community of multifamily dwellings that provide community neighborhood support and play places and food growing places, like those garden things that are outside. You could even build things like hoop houses and greenhouses out of recyclable materials so that they don't cost too much. There's so many ideas that just flood my head, but I know it's all communist thinking and I have to just get it out before I turn into Yuri Zhivago. I don't know. I'm not sure what's wrong with me sometimes. On the other hand, you might start thinking about multifamily homes and the death of the American single-family home before we have another 2008, which we're about to do. Get ready, everybody, to lose your house. Get ready to lose the single-family house. But instead of having to move out of it, maybe you could split it and share it. Instead of us all having to be out on the street not knowing where we're going to be, maybe we could get used to sharing kitchens and bathrooms. I know nobody likes to do that, but it's not so bad. Use incense. Incense. Open the window. I know it's not. Nobody likes to do it, but it's not that bad. And in the end, you get more jokes out of it. Hey, did you see Ralph?